have some right by virtue of that time, but that still doesn't, it perhaps gives them a right to come and criticize, but it doesn't really give them a right to stay in the village and take the side they want to leave. This is what is happening. It's an area that needs a lot of development. Jeff, I'm sorry, I just asked you a question back. You know, I don't know the answer.
Any other comments on that?
Well, I know you have a comment, but if this inconceivable would be a, the US Constitution, the Alaska Constitution, that every Alaska citizen would have, every Alaska school child would have an education. Every taxpayer, every resident, regardless of their status, the village just mentioned, there's probably major residents, white residents, and so forth. There's no basis for distinction between our people, no basis for race, or society, but participation they can have in school affairs at the local level. As I see it, I'm the West Constitution, the state constitution, and all of the people.
Well, what I agree with, and I'm sure all of us are agreeing with that as the, probably the ideal situation. I think John's concern is one that the state has been aware of for a long time. It's one that maybe there's been a little bit of the ostrich in the sand. It is a problem that, in some respects, perhaps it's been good that we're not trying to deal directly with, but in a myriad types of issues have they come up. Whether you're talking about the Human Child Welfare Act, which provides an entirely different standard for relinquishment of child custody for Indian children as opposed to non-Indian children in this country, and that is frankly a real problem for the Alaska court system, particularly where we have numerous villages that are now expressing some interest in setting up their own tribal courts, and where we have in fact some communities that have tribal courts functioning, where concepts of due process really have not applied. And I think in this respect, John, the concerns about teaching staff and the rights or lack of them in any community is a real one. Unfortunately, I think one that we have somehow or another largely been able to avoid, but Tyonek is not the only area. Benatai, Yukon Flats, a couple of years ago at one point, refused to admit any state officials to come into the community because of their position that we were dealing with the sovereign community of Benatai, and that it was, in fact, a sovereign, dependent nation under the U.S. Constitution, not subject to the law of the state of Alaska. So that issue is out there. And it's one that I don't think the state, frankly, has really developed a strategy.
I'd like to make a comment, if I might. I am Bill Hatch, the principal of the Department of School for the last 3 years until my transfer this year. I'd like to point out one thing that you may not be clear on. This is in Tyonek. It's been under the Department of School, and evidently there was one in the state of Alaska. In the Tyonek situation, we must realize that it is, first of all, a public school, not an IRA school. BIA school. This is not one you. Public school is part of in Alba, and it's a school district. Entirely different matter. Also, involving the rights of white or non-native people who live in the Tyonek area, primarily concerned employment issues and concerned whether two families, representative of the community, could or could not stay there. In the case of the Puckett family, Mrs. Puckett is my secretary in the school, and my feelings are that primarily since that job had formerly been held by a native, that the question arose as to whether it would be best at this particular time and place for some non-native to take the job. Mrs. Puckett took the job, and she had also worked for the school district some 4 years prior to that. And at the time that she took the job, she had a Title I position in the school, primarily a transfer rather than putting someone out of work. Even in the case of the Slauson family, that was an inherent right based upon the fact that Mrs. Lawson's grandchildren, literally the children, were Native Americans, and it's an interracial marriage situation. It's preposterous in both particular cases, not only the fact that it's a public school, part of the state of Alaska, federal school system, but it dealt in matters which certainly will be resolved by the court. And I still feel that what I did and what was done at that time, not only legally right, but the time will be proven, but it was definitely morally right.
Bill, just to respond, though, I think whether or not you're dealing with a public school, the problem is still there. You have the same thing in Vinatown, which is it is an REAA school run by Yukon Flats. The fact that your location, that is the fact you live in the community, is subject to whatever laws govern there, to allow what happens, your location, and the control exercise there, to control what happens in the classroom or in the school. And Tyonek is a, as I see it, and again from an outsider's viewpoint, is an attempt to affect what happens in the school by where you live. And that is to say, if you don't cooperate, you don't do it the way we want it done, we have the power, the authority to expel you, exile you basically, ban you from the community. And I think it's a real risk. Again, I don't, fortunately, it's not so far been an issue in most of the state, although again, council of village chiefs, Panama chiefs, in various parts of the state, particularly Laura Cusperman, have been looking at that issue, that it, the overall issue of sovereignty, and again, very active in the Panama Valley. So I think it is a problem that could rear itself in various parts of the state.
Any other questions from the audience concerning the three areas of local regulations, school funding, education, and retirement?
To comment, I hope we don't go to the 20th state. It only allows you to do what's good rather than just get the code. So, the kind of concern that was legitimate at the local district level, manually or semi-annually review policy and regulation, could not be a legitimate action of the state to review legislation and regulation after. And in fact, sometimes some procedures and processes.
There's certainly nothing impermissible about it. I think you're questioning, you're really asking if it's wise to implement such a policy. I think it is prudent to review the laws governing any particular field. The legislature has attempted to do that in very limited areas. They have provided some sunsetting for various state agencies in the past, putting them on a four-year cycle in essence. Is the Professional Teaching Practices Commission one of those that is regularly scheduled for sunsetting?
Nothing has been done in that recent years.
Okay. But by and large, the education community of the state didn't sort of review in terms of organization. And it doesn't address the other aspect of it, which is quite apart from whether the organization should exist or how it should exist, whether it's modified. There really hasn't been any overall review of the statutes of the department or the regulations of the department external to the department. It actually has gone on internally. I know that this last year, Steve Hall was assigned the responsibility of reviewing all the regulations of the department. In fact, there has been some substantial push internally to modify several regulations. Nothing public.
My recollection, I'm not a little less than personal experience, but from what I've read and been told, is that early in statehood, the education title of Chapter 14 was in fact totally recodified on, I believe, the 1949 code that created statehood, and I think in 1969, the last time that the entire code was essentially rewritten and recodified. Occasionally that sort of thing has happened in other areas. I think some different kinds of sense I have to hear back in 72, 73, so before the entire municipal code. To me, it makes sense that the legislature, just like anybody else, to 2017 that are at very least moribund, if not stupid. That sometimes there's a, for instance, I believe in there's a teacher's section dealing with minimum pay for teachers, which 15-year-old high school kid working part-time at the Xerox machine are basically making more money than that salary schedule. So why that is in the statute is
Jerry's old enough.
Education. In the Matsu world does this. You get more kids into the classrooms, which includes librarians, special ed teachers, and many other categories of people who are not really in first grade classroom or second grade classroom. The average state teacher student ratio is 14, which is below the national average. The average ratio in the Matsu world is 19, and primarily because of crowding. We'll have almost surely have to is double shifting next year. That means those junior high school kids will be deprived of extra opportunities for extracurricular activities because some of them will be picked up about 12:30 in the afternoon and will be taken home. They're not going to be doing all the things that they junior high school kids need to do in the way of athletics, Spanish stuff, and so forth that they need to have around the education. I think they still have the afternoon shift. That's what they have in their family life. Those kids get home 4 hours before their parents do. We're lucky and we're not going to have to do a lot of busing. Eventually we may, at one time we did because we placed an elementary school in a double location. And people who live in my subdivision were being bused and towed about 20 miles every day, 10 miles from the school to the elementary school, 10 miles back. That's what happens when we have differential rates of growth in the school district. And you can't build schools here. Most of the any school district budget is teacher salaries, so if you run short of money, what you do is you cut back on the teachers. You cut out that money.
Are there any other questions in the audience?
Yes, correct.
I think that last my comment is an interesting one because if the issue comes, one of the things that Peter ought to add to his list maybe people might want to look at is reduction in force. Because there's an obvious place where the regulations and statutes in our conflict, the regulations say that you can reduce in force to a dismissal with 30 days notice, but the statutes say that layoff is not a reason for dismissal. There are only three reasons for dismissal. And I'd rather be on John's side of the issue, unfortunately, I'll be able to, if we do have to lay off.
Yeah, if we listen to Mortimer's speech, I'm sure John will be happy here at the 6-to-1. That's more teachers, but probably maybe not quite as happy if those teachers are confused.
I like Harry Wong's approach. In fact, I think I'd like Harry Wong's approach to anything. I was wondering how his presence on the panel or his question might have changed his whole arrangement. How many of you heard Harry Wong's speech? He talked about a four-way grid. Low control to high control, low support to high support. And he talked about how it works in classroom. I think it works in the same way in the government level, too. If the executive branch is holding off to see what the judicial does, the education or judicial is hanging back to see what the legislature is going to do, and hope God has a problem in their lap. Or the state board says, oh, God, let's keep the profile that the governor makes up his mind. Administrators are hurt, then kids and families are hurt. So I would like to see state philosophy, the resolution that we all keep a high, assertive and authoritative all the way. The governor, legislature, the boards expect the school administrators and teachers to keep this high. If anybody doesn't have a high, board of education should get the hell out.
Any other questions from the audience?
I do have a comment or two. Based on formal recognition. Mr. Girl and I observe somewhat the same situation with respect to a bit of pork
barreling in capital improvements commission. I'm president of the Felicia Region School District, and he and I are in far different circumstances, but we are also in the same circumstance of being in dire need in certain areas. When I first came onto the school board, I presumed that there would be a rational method of determining need within the state. And indeed, I saw a rational method function. We, within the district, hired excellent people, architects, engineers, school planners, to go to our villages, to make up school plans, to find out what was needed, to evaluate our present facilities, and so forth. We prepared these school plans. We compared them to educational requirements within the state, and so forth. So we prepared these things, sent them to the next step, a very rational type of procedure. The Department of Education, those people at that level, examined things, compared our needs to other needs, prioritized things into what I considered a rational list. It was a good list. We, of course, say ours are very important, but other people say theirs are very important also. So, obviously, a rational method was employed at that level to prepare a list. And that rationally prepared list was sent to the governor. At that point, all rationality appeared to break down someplace in the political arena. You would think that if you have three of your schools in the top 10 or 11 in priority, that if 15 or 20 projects were funded, that at least one or two of those, three of those projects would be funded. That isn't the case. You can have the number one need in this state, and it will not be funded. And we go to our legislators and say, gee, we ask, you know, $10 million of it. We need $10 million. We've justified $10 million. The Department of Education said we need $10 million. And we're told, gee, you know, that's a lot of money. We can't ask for $10 million at once. And we say, but look, you ignored us out here for 10 years, 15 years. We didn't get anything. What prevents you from asking for $10 million now, according to this rational plan? Okay, things break down when it comes to politics. You have a need, I have a need. The distribution of state funds should be based on that documented need and a rational plan. It should not get into politics. We should not be building a gym where somebody has a gym when we are cramming K through 12 into one dinky little room someplace else. So I would advise and hope to heaven that somebody continues the rational policy into the legislature.
The thing you need to do, and if people agree with that basic statement, there's only one word that needs to be changed, and that is the word may to shall. The process that you're referring to is that found in AS 1411, which makes it available for any school district which wants to put in, make a request, and that will be prioritized according to a criteria, to the criteria set out in that statute and supplemented by regulations. But it's not mandatory. And in fact, most of the, I won't say most, but a majority of the school-funded projects in the state don't go through that process. My recollection is that last year, the total amount on that list, which did not by far encompass everything that went through, totaled something like $600 million, and which indicates what districts see as their needs. It's clearly a much more rational process than what happens in the legislature. But until you convince the legislature, and if they convince Matsuburo, as an example, which is one of the big offenders in going the other way to get money, Gary, and you insist that they go through that prioritizing list, we're going to have the kind of problems you're referring to. It's not that you're going to eliminate it, because still there's a degree of subjectivity that comes to deciding what those priorities are. I think it's a fallacy to think that the system is objective simply because we have identified six classifications. Somebody had to decide that unhoused students were somehow less important than health and safety, as an example. It may be rational, but it still is a choice that was made. Nevertheless, it is more rational than deciding to do the end run. So I'd say that if you're really concerned about it, the first thing you do is you convince your legislative delegations to change the word so it's mandatory rather than permissive. And then everybody has their cards on the table. And we know what the overall picture is. I don't think it's going to happen, in part because I think legislators like some degree of flexibility in deciding what their priorities are. And in fact, there are some other elements that go in there that don't show up in that priority list. An example is the Molly Hooch case, really the consent decree doesn't figure into that list directly. Although I can tell you that, again, Aleutian Region is probably going to be getting close to $2 million, not because it was on the list, for Accutan and Colts Pass, because under the decree, we neglected you, and now 6 years later, we discovered that you should have gotten secondary facilities there. That isn't going through that process. So I mean, there are some other factors that are plugging in. But I think the bottom line is subject every school district to that prioritizing list. Then we know what everybody wants. And we allow the legislature and the governor both to see really where the comparative worth is of various projects. And that right now doesn't pass. And I think that is a valid. I just hope that Gary will make sure that all your projects go only through 1411, because I think that's the basic argument that you are making in the case, is that that should be the system. And nevertheless, again, I hope that that's the only way you go this year.
Gary?
After the judge rendered a decision, I think that would be the only way we go, but till then, everything's fair. The governor has some control. The things that he thinks are just terrible, he can veto them, and he does. What he can't do is get the appropriation and submit it to him. And what happened with that last list is the first $12.5 million on the Department of Education list, which you referred to, was totally ignored by the legislature. They had no interest in it. This is what the governor said to Bill Hayes when he was explaining with a series of vetoes of various school items. The legislature should appropriate a level of funding for these programs so that statewide needs are addressed. The legislature should avoid the designation of individual funding recipients. This practice results in unplanned development of programs through an accumulation of single designated grants. Some of the grants for education purposes have been vetoed and so forth. So this is the relief we're asking of the courts, that everyone go through the process that you described. We'll take our chances if that's done. We'll have to.
A response, though, again, I mean, you realize that what you're saying is to all the school administrators and the school board members out here, that you're basically proposing their ability to go directly to the legislator in the session and prove that they've done a good job by being able to lobby that additional 7,000 for paraprofessional or computer system, which that individual school board is interested in. You're really taking away that which distinguishes a good legislator from a bad one. And unfortunately, I think also that's the way we evaluate administrators in this state. Can they bring it home? I don't say that that's the appropriate criteria, but I think that the reality is that it is the criteria that. By and large, the governance, whether a person gets reelected, and governance, whether you consider your business manager to have done a good job or your business to do a good job. Happy to run the bacon.
That's good. Do we have any other questions other than Matsu, Borough, and the state?
Only gentlemen, children in school, and children in school.
Why would that be important?
I was going to show you Harry Wong's, not everybody else has seen it, you haven't. If you have children in school, you ought to see this. It helps you to evaluate people.
Yeah, I think maybe somebody else.
Yes, sir.
This raises the same point. The old formula that many states used were based on average daily attendance, which meant that you go on the page, the kids showed up and were subjected to the teacher of the book. We got to escape from that, but average daily membership, which means a lot of the name was carried on the roll. The school district got a big money for that. Well, many of the school districts, tried all kinds of schools to make sure the children showed up or provided homebound instruction or correspondence instruction. Other school districts bypassed that. How would people feel about either some combination of daily attendance or daily membership as a way of helping people, pupils, in a formula that you may develop in the next 2 years?
I'll throw myself in to answer that, and I'll throw in another test team I have, which you showed up anyway. I think that basically it's about who happens to be there on a particular day doesn't make much sense, but if kids happen to be sick or whatever, you have to have, if you've got 25 kids in a classroom, you have to have a teacher there, whether it's only 20 of them show up on a given day or not.
Everything else up here.
But another thing that is unrelated, but is a problem that a number of the school districts I represent have had over a number of years, and it's been a change in the statutes in the mid-70s, have to do, and this maybe ties into a lot of the other issues that the educators are more interested in, have to do with the compulsory attendance laws A and the truancy law B. The current, talking about the question the gentleman asked earlier about looking at the statute, if you want to see a silly statute at some point, look at the state's compulsory education statute and the manner in which it is enforced or enforceable. It's an absurd statute. Furthermore, in the mid-70s, for I think legitimate purposes, amendment was done in the Children's Code so that habitual truancy is no longer a basis for looking at a child as being a child in need of aid or supervision in any fashion by the Department of Health and Social Services. My belief, and I have had to advise a number of school districts on this occasion, that there is, other than the threats which don't have any force behind them, there's no way in the state at this time that a child whose parents do not want to see the kid in school can force a child to be in school. And I think it's a situation that should be looked into.
So that's
a
question.
I did that very hard, maybe a second one.
I think from the administration standpoint of view, I think that definitely, to answer your question, would be the ADM, I guess I can't really answer it, I guess I can just tell you how to do it, is that ADM is a much more equitable way to go insofar as planning. If we had more control over the amount of dollars that were provided to us in education, direct control, maybe ADA wouldn't be so bad. But when you don't know what you're going to get from year to year to year, ADM's got to be the way to go.
That's
the
most interactive way to go, because you have to eat the classroom and everything else. But the question that then arises is there some sort of spur that you can reward the district to get provide an education with power, regardless of where it is. That's just one of the many questions that's going to be arising when we're redrawing the formula. Because there are individual administrators, not using school districts, but the solutions and problems children have got at a junior high or higher level is essentially a force out. They have a trade-off in both directions. I've got no answer if I'm asking the questions.
And I think, you know, from the, again, my personal point of view, that the reason that we have so many rules and regulations is, to me, is primarily tied to those sources of funding. Whenever somebody has the dollars, they also want to control the rules. A simple system of funding would be to somehow devise a cost per student that it included all capital construction, education, special education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then let the local communities decide what to do with those dollars on an equitable basis. Naturally, you'd have to have emergency funds for situations where you had catastrophes or where you had rapid increase in population. However, I think that most of us can plan increases in population for at least a year or more in advance.
Hearing that there are a lot of legislation and regulations that are stupid or don't work, or they make the districts do things that cost the district money to do just because they've got to devote the staff to doing it. And the only thing I'm hearing from you is that the only vehicle for correcting this is to go to the legislative course and have them change the regulations. Or every once in a while, internally, you clean house and look at your own regulations. I mean, what I don't understand is I'm hearing a lot of dumb things going on all the time, and I haven't heard any way to go about doing anything about it except somebody gets together in a group and they go talk to their legislator, and if they know the right people and if there's enough of them, they can get that changed. But if they live really far away and they don't know the right people, they're not going to be able to get it changed.
Well, first of all, you have to make a distinction between statutes and regulations. Statutes are exclusively within the legislative prerogative. And again, I think most of the battles that deal with statutes directly, at least in terms of state experience, most of them deal with money, in terms of state relationships with school districts, without exception. Whether you're talking about pupil transportation, whether you're talking about foundation funding, and those are the main questions there. At the local level, deal, I think, primarily with the question of two areas, pupil-teacher relations in terms of discipline and the questions of retention. And there are a lot of other statutes that are out there that never get questioned because, by and large, the system works. But again, that's what the litigation is. Largely deal with the statutory question. Then you have the regulations of the department promulgated by the Board of Education. And then there's a couple other exceptions. The Professional Teaching Practices Commission has the authority to promulgate regulations dealing with conflicts with educators for practices together with educators. And again, if you're not satisfied, there really is. Those who create the regulations or those who have the sole authority to actually change them. Courts have the power to strike them down. But in terms of the changing, that power rests with ultimately with the Board of Education as it affects the education team. And so all your attempts, if there's a need, ultimately have to go to that bottleneck. And again, as I said at the outset, the ways you can deal with it are to petition on your own, as an organization, as an individual, as a public body, here before them. And every meeting provides for that public comment to write to them in a more informal way, or to deal directly with department officials and staff to suggest the changes to be made. It may seem simplistic, but that really, that's the bottom line in terms of how they get changed. I don't know that there are really that many that don't work. I can tell you that there are a few that don't are heavily litigated or appear not to. There's a subtle suggestion, perhaps, that maybe we don't need the regulations. And I guess whether or not we could argue that philosophically, but the state Supreme Court has made very clear that wherever government attempts to set standards, it must do so in a form called a regulation, and that it must be adopted in accordance with the Alaska Administrative Procedure Act. That requirement has been around a long time, but the Supreme Court, fairly in the last several years, has slapped down state government a couple times very emphatically for its failure to follow the Administrative Procedure Act. So we have to have the guidelines.
And it makes a lot of sense, because if we say that government is going to try and deal with the affairs of the public, whether it's people in school districts or individuals, then it should be doing it in a fair manner. And one way of showing that fairness is that there have been pre-established standards which have been subjected to public review and public comment, and that everybody knows what the ground rules are.
I'd like to respond to that also. I think that's what I alluded to in my final question. Maybe didn't state it as well as it could have been stated, is that I think one of the things that we have to understand in our state, we are a new state, we are learning, and one of the things that I see lacking, and I'm as guilty, is the lack of communication. I see a lack of communication from the Teachers Association to the Principals Association, Administrators Association, the School Boards Association. And if this communication was better and more widely used, we wouldn't have the problems, and we would have the input to the state level to change some regulations so they would be fair.
I don't think there's any one system that is going to have some of the problems that here in the education area. Good civics class teach people how to use the system. The system is there, and it's not that complicated. People don't know how to use it or don't take the time to use it. And the other question is, are there enough regulations? Not a lot of people will take on regulations where they think it's just great. You're not going to get used to everything on time, whether it's just regulations you just don't have.
I mean, just reflecting on that comment, I recall getting scathing notes from both either John at some point of either teacher retirement or part of your service, and we were trying to defend it as a part of regulation that nobody really knew what it was. So many of them.
Are there any other questions? It's about 4:30 right now. Yes, sir.
There's more of a comment that the system is working. I recall, I'm not too anxious, but I recall the mission had to do with the Department of Education, but they're related to the Department of Health and Social Services. And they had had to do with private schools, but it had to do with local schools, got to school where I come in at. But they had a hearing that was very poorly advertised, but the word got out, and there was no room, was way too small. So they had to reschedule a hearing to, I think, one of the big high schools here. They had about 800 people at that hearing. And most of the comments was against the regulation. They took it all under advisement for several months, and then came out and said we're going to put it into the regulations anyway. And it hadn't been for the committee in funeral, in picture of some of those, they were put into regulation. But there was enough complaint again, so they scheduled another hearing. So the pressure got so hot that the politicians finally said, I think the governor must have said, hey, we've got to do it.
Those were the early childhood regulations.
Mm-hmm. But it had to do with space and all kinds of things, and that's the kind of communication that makes us as common citizens think, hey, this government is not very responsive. And after a few legislators that, the policies are more dangerous than the facts, the policies of and I think that if there's any word from this plain old common citizen school board member, what sense are hearing if when you get a predominance of no, you just sit down and do it for a while, and then there's no good with affecting it. And the governor told he didn't know if there was going to be
that, however, I think is or. I know there's seeing in the crowd here that there's several public officials who are elected public officials. And I think anyone in that position realizes the risk that simply by having 700 people turn out to an auditorium, often, sometimes without sufficient information, or reacting to the wrong issue. And I'm not saying that that was the case here. Although, I can tell you that some of my friends in health and social services clearly thought that to be the case. That you can't be swayed simply by the pressure that comes in there. If in your best judgment, as an elected official, the public is best served by some other form. And that is an age-old debate that has, happens in education as it does in every field. The question, am I there to represent, that is, to count noses, or am I elected there because my constituents concluded that I would exercise my best judgment based on the information provided me through not only the hearing process, but by whatever other sources of information I have. And I think ultimately one has to remember in that specific example that the legislature has specifically charged both the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Social Services to promulgate regulations dealing with early childhood. I think the ultimate result, though, of everything that's happened is that you're going to see the legislature probably trying to override the governor's veto of, I think it was House Bill 357, which would, in essence, deregulate that entire area. So maybe it, in some far stretch of the imagination, proves how well the system works in responding to the public.
Yes, we almost have to be the FBI to keep up with it.
That is a problem.
That's the point I'm making.
And the legislature has tried. The legislature has tried to deal with that in one sense. They adopted this year or enacted a statute creating the Alaska Administrative Journal. And obviously, not everybody in the state is going to subscribe to it, but it's going to provide yet another mechanism rather than going to the back pages of your newspaper to see whether in small print there's a notice dealing with regulations, is to try and also on a regular basis put out a publication which would allow citizens to know what all government agencies are doing in adopting emergency regulations as opposed to regular regulations, delegations of authority, and the like. So it's certainly a concern, and I think the legislature is trying to address that.
One thing I just might follow up real quickly, in terms of administrative regulations, there is a provision that in the State Administrative Procedures Act, these regulations have to be published in the newspapers and sent out to all interested persons. And my belief is that, for instance, if you're dealing specifically with education, you're really concerned with the Department of Education regulations, you can write a letter to the commissioner's office indicating that you are an interested person. Here's my address. Please make sure that a copy of all notices of regulations get sent to me. And they, I believe, are legally required to send you the notices of the regulations as they go up.
That's
only send you the notice of intent to change and not the specifics of what the intent to change it to.
So I realize that's right two letters every time. I've been, that's the proof unless you know that something is there.
So you have never know what they're going to go to.
That's a good point.
No,
I was just going to say that Alaska right now is changing from a small personal state to a more impersonal state. Lots of times our problems are not with our legislators, but with some of the bureaucrats that come in and write some of these regulations. And a lot of those things that a lot of them really what we're talking about. A lot of those are really busy earning their living. While we agree with Mr. Thomas Jefferson, who said, practice liberty is eternal vigilance.
How are we doing? Is everybody getting bored? Is it time to leave, or do we have some more questions? We got about 20 minutes left scheduled time. Anybody else?
Change
tax
and minute.
I guess my own reaction is that the long-term repercussions, as I see it, particularly if we see additional pressure to make up for those losses in the legislature, given the fact that we're looking at maybe a long-term decline in revenues, we're going to have to increasingly go back and rely on local property taxes to subsidize local education. And to the extent that that impacts, there is a given right now at least, and that is there isn't any local taxation for the REAAs, and I think the legislature has a trust obligation, a fiduciary obligation to deal with those districts first. They are, in essence, the assembly for the unorganized borough. And what's left over in terms of the education pot is what's going to get divided, and it isn't going to be enough to keep this voracious animal called municipal education going. It isn't going to feed Anchorage. I think the Anchorage citizens will, if they want the quality of education they've had, seriously look at either two things. They either repeal their limitation, or they're going to end up cutting back other governmental services. I just don't see it being made up in the legislation. Not only for the kinds of political repercussions that we'll have with legislators from other parts of the state, but just given the financial picture of the state overall.
Is there any other questions? Answers? Sir? That concludes the discussion. Thank you very much to the panel members. Thank you, it's not easy.